Well, congratulations, you made it. I feel like I should do the Henry V soliloquy. You know, we few, we happy few. So I'm going to limit the number of equations, realizing this is the end of a long day for a long enough conference. But I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me. It's been very interesting, if not terribly elucidating, actually. I'm more confused now than I was Wednesday morning. And so I want to tell you something about how the Event Horizon Telescope might say something both about gravity generally, but also importantly about quantum gravity. So what does a black hole look like? Let's start with what a classical black hole looks like. It looks like that. They're very boring. Hard to see. Astronomers don't like those ones. But as I think we all know, that black holes plus stuff are some of the brightest things in the universe. Here's a simulation of a black hole with the surrounding accretion flow. The components in this image are essentially due to relativistic motion, which results in the asymmetry. The one side's bright, the other side's dim because of relativistic orbital motion. Gravitational lensing, we see this large ring-like feature. The thing inside of that is what we call the shadow. This is the image of the horizon. It's caused by the instability of the photon orbit. And astrophysical processes that determine the radial structure of the emission region and the processes by which the emission is produced. Okay, so this is sort of a typical image for the black hole at the center of our galaxy. The characteristic scale of this image is about 10 gravitational radii in projection, so 10m over d if you wanted in angular units, and that's about 53 microarc seconds. So that's factors of few to an order of magnitude higher resolution than the highest previous observations made in astronomy. So how are we going to go after this? This is what the Event Horizon Telescope is designed to do. It's a large global collaboration, 13 institutions, far more affiliated institutions. One thing that's kind of fun is this is a map of the world, and the green regions are the parts where we have partners. Yes, we have Antarctica. So we have two continents to go. It's a global array of millimeter and submillimeter facilities. We've lost a few, and we're gaining a few next year. This is what it looks like as of April 2017. And with whichever of these actually become operational for us in 2018. And I think actually we anticipate NOIMA and the Greenland Telescope. The big change in 2017 for us was the introduction of ALMA. So this is the largest millimeter telescope in the world, extremely sensitive and an anchor of our array. And the way that radio interferometry works is we essentially measure the electric field at the aperture of our telescope. And over time, each pair of telescopes gives us one point in spatial frequency space, and over time we fill in this aperture. And then on big computers, we bring all the light to focus and make images. It's called Earth aperture synthesis. I just wanted to point out that if we want to make a nice picture, it takes a night. The result is the highest resolution telescope in the history of astronomy. We can watch hockey on the moon and resolve the puck. And that's sufficient to image black hole horizons. And when I say images, I really mean images. This is a simulation of our imaging pipeline. It says simulation across. Okay. There's an input image. Simulated data was produced and appropriately molested by noise, and then reconstructed the image on the right there. Okay. So we should be able to see shadows. I do want to point out that the EHT first image quality observations were made this past April. We haven't analyzed them fully yet. But in the prior decade, we've been observing with a smaller array, a Pathfinder array called the Proto-EHT, just a three-station array. It has Earth-sized baselines and it probes horizon-scale structures, but you can't make pictures with it. The EHT is data rich. It's not just about making pictures. We get the direct radio interferometry observables things that are related to the Fourier transform of the image, but we can do this in all polarizations. We can do this at more than one frequency. We can do this from on timescales from seconds to decades now. And we can do this for more than one target. And everything in green is something that we've done with the Pathfinder array. The only thing we're missing, really, is higher frequencies. And we're moving towards that, I think, for 2019. Okay, so before I talk about quantum black holes, since this has come up a number of times, let me just remark very quickly. I'm going to fly through a number of topics the EHT has already addressed or can address in classical gravity. So the first one, upon request, is a discussion of whether or not black hole horizons exist. So this is an argument that we started making many years ago and goes back to arguments made by Ramesh Narayan and Jeremy Heil comparing X-ray binaries, black hole and neutron star X-ray binaries. The idea is that accretion onto a star is very different than accretion onto something with a horizon, because in a star you'll get a boundary flow which will heat up and radiate thermally, and so you can go look for the thermal bump. If we don't know what we're looking at, and we don't know how big it is, the location of this thermal bump isn't known a priori, but with EHT we have a size constraint, and so we know how big that thermalized region could possibly be. We have some idea then in the spectrum of where that thermal bump is. Generically, any high redshift object will be producing something that looks thermal simply because it's this idealized black body cavity. Only a handful of the rays ever escape. All the rest of them couple to different locations on the surface. And you might worry that if you put the surface at high redshift, it will take forever for it to couple to itself and thermalize. But in practice, you only lose logarithmically on time because things go out first and then over and then back down. So here's a little movie that shows what happens to the spectrum as you put a bright feature in the middle, and this is all in the near infrared. You can see you have some power law component from the accretion flow, and then you get this bump as promised. And we can constrain that. It's not present in Sagittarius Star. It's also not present in M87, our primary second target. I guess that makes it our secondary target. So we have at least two sources that we can make this sort of astrophysical argument for a horizon. I would note, aside from the caveats I listed in the previous page, and I'm happy to discuss, I often get flack for claiming that we detect event horizons. I realize that we do not live at future infinity, so at best these are apparent horizons. I also realize that the universe is young in comparison to the page time, so while we do have traction over the past 10 billion years, we have some time to go. There's also ways out of the argument, things like high heat capacities, long equilibration times, things that aren't in steady state like black holes. I just wanted to point out that here's one example where we tried to make this argument with a gravistar type model. This is the Laughlin and Chaplin model. They were kind enough to give us something where you could calculate heat capacities. And we can effectively rule out models like that, but who knows?
Sorry, so that's excluding, what is this excluding?
Well, okay, so there's, in the Laughlin and Chaplin model, there's a scale below which some new microscopic theory is supposed to appear, right? Gravity's emergence. This is the energy scale, and this is the length scale in Planck units. And with a combination of different sources, you can effectively eliminate everything from the Planck scale upward in that particular model.
Maybe we could come back in the discussion. I'm just wondering what that translates into in redshift.
How
redshifted on those surfaces.
Yeah.
But it's not obvious from your graph. Maybe you know the answer.
I'd have to think about it. We published that too long ago for me to admit now. Okay, so... that next kind of constraint, so that's sort of qualitative. The idea of just putting a size constraint with the EHT allows us to start making arguments about whether or not there's an emitting photosphere. The next kind of thing that we'll be able to do fairly quickly is just use the size scale of the shadow. Okay, so we can measure that reasonably well, and you know, to better than 10%. And that means that since this depends upon the mass divided by the distance, it's very weakly dependent on spin. In fact, that 10% is mostly due to uncertainty in the spin if we assume nothing about it. We can put a line on this mass distance parameter plot for Sagittarius Star, and there's at least two other constraints for that. We have, Maser constraints to the center of the galaxy, and you have the stellar orbits that are observed. And so that means we have a test of gravity, right? They should all cross at one point. It's sort of like the mass-mass plots for pulsars. The difference being that the EHT measurements are measuring, in some sense, mass on scales of the photon orbit. Eugene just mentioned pulsars. I want to point out that the EHT does a lot of can do commensal science. We phased up ALMA. One of the problems with finding pulsar black hole binaries, at least for the galactic center, is that everything should be badly scatter broadened, so it's hard to find them. The main point is that you want to go to higher frequencies, but the problem with higher frequencies is the flux from pulsars, the brightness of pulsars drops precipitously. So if you want to find them, one way to do it is to take ALMA and phase it up into one dish, which is what we did for the EHT anyway. The SKA should clean up on this, but this gives us a high frequency pulsar survey that can be done at the same time as other ALMA science. Okay, just skip over that. So that's just from putting effectively a ruler on top of first images from the EHT. If we wanted to go a little bit more into detail and model accretion flows, and we do know a lot about the environment of Sagittarius Star. Here's an X-ray image, so we know there's a lot of hot gas. Here's a radio image. We see a very bright point source. We have spectra. We have spectral polarimetry. We have the mass from the stellar orbits, and we have some theoretical bias and what kind of models we think ought to apply. And then you can ask, well, which of those fit the best? And here's an example of one such analysis. I don't want you to read the axes so much as just to note that there's a lot of low probability blue in this constraint and a very narrow sliver of high probability red. And this is from existing data. This is from the Pathfinder experiment. Okay, just to give you an idea of how constraining that is, here's a list of images taken on the 1 sigma contour. So these are the 1 sigma image family. They all do differ. It's hard for me to see it. We can exclude some phenomenological pictures. So this makes me think if Sagittarius Star is a gravistar and it's transparent, I can't say for sure that we would have excluded it, but it feels like that would be tough at the moment. It's not transparent, who knows? The parameters that we get from this estimate include the orientation of the spin, okay, both its inclination and its position angle on the sky. And you could ask, does that match up with nearby features, things like other orbiting gas clouds in the galactic center or the disk of stars that's presumed to be responsible for its accretion flow? The answer is yes. Why is that important? Well, it gives me some confidence. I hope it gives you some confidence that we know how to model the astrophysics a little bit, the accretion flow. And then you can say, well, given the astrophysics, let's vary the underlying spacetime. And so that's what we've also started to do, just perturb the spacetime in some parametric fashion. And in this case, we use a quasi-Kerr metric. So this is, you know, sort of an abuse of the Hartle-Thorne metric. And it gives us the control over the quadrupole. So we can modify the quadrupole moment. We can make our black holes space-time more prolate or more oblate. When you do that, you can again go through and obtain constraints, in this case on spin magnitude and this perturbation. Okay, so one is large. In 2009, this is what the constraints would have looked like. 2013, we're starting to rule things out at 2 sigma at least. This is what we should be able to do with the current data, assuming that our modeling, our astrophysical modeling, isn't terrible. This is sub-percent constraints on things like quadrupoles.
So is this your kind of best estimate for the spin right now, 0.15?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. That's right. Isn't that the data?
This is simulated data. That's our best estimate. The error bars on that today are large.
Yeah.
Taking a step back and asking, well, wait a minute, what about all that astrophysics? Surely that's going to be a big problem. We've started to look at how big a problem that really realistically might be. The astrophysics imposes itself in a number of different ways. It turns out that the main effect of changing the structure of the spacetime is to change the lensing and change the dynamics, both of which were included in the previous picture. The radial structures in the disk, so the radial structure of the density and the temperature, are essentially unchanged. Each one of these plots have 3 different lines for 3 different spacetimes. They're all on top of each other. Okay, so I don't think it's actually that sensitive. We do know that Sagittarius star is variable, so here's an MHD movie MHD simulation movie of Sagittarius star. You can see all kinds of variability associated with turbulent structures in the accretion flow. We do see flares, both in the infrared and the X-ray, as well as in the millimeter. And sometimes we see what look like periodic structures, which suggest maybe instead of burbling in the accretion flow, we're seeing something like concentrated spots that remain coherent for multiple orbits. And if we see those, then you can tomographically map the space-time by comparing the lensed images of those spots at different times. Now, I said you can only make images on a night. The time scale for that's 20, 27 minutes or so. So practically, you need to be looking at the direct measured observables from the interferometric experiment, so these Fourier transforms. Here's some sample data for two different sets of time variable images. The details of what the data is aren't so important so much as the fact that there are error bars on all these little points for what we expect to have already now in 2017. This was produced before April. And so it's exquisite sensitivity. Okay, so now let's get to the main point of the talk. What do quantum black holes look like? This is related to this paper that Whaley, Penn, and I produced on studying the effects on black hole pulsar observations, binary observations. And in some sense, this is sort of a practical addendum to Steve Gitting's talk on how might this really look for an EHT-like experiment. One important point that I think is somewhat interesting is where is the emission coming from that we're seeing? And so here's a movie that shows what happens if you cut out the emission inside of some radius. Okay? It turns out that about 2% of our emission comes from inside the photon orbit. And you saw the size of the error bars. Okay, that's going to be easily detectable. We're probably going to do considerably better than that. 80% of the emission comes inside the innermost stable circular orbit. Okay, so we really are probing down to the horizon. So what if we do have a quantum black hole? So the space-time is not classical, but it's defined by some quantum state. What are we going to see? Is it going to be fuzzy? Should we be thinking about expectation values of the metric, or should we think about quantum states? And the answer is it's not going to be fuzzy, right? We make a measurement. My undergraduate quantum mechanics told me that should project the system into an eigenstate of my observable. Okay, so I should expect to see something like what Steve showed the other day, some sort of fluctuating set of images. But there are two severe complications. The first is we have a comparatively small number of radio photons. Now that's a statement that you'll almost never hear anyone say, because in the radio we have a ridiculous number of photons. In 20 seconds we'll get about 10 billion photons from our source, but of course there's many, many more states. Okay, so we're always in the weak measurement limit. And the second is the black hole is constantly buffeted by accreting material, incoming photons, et cetera, that are all much more energetic than the Hawking photons, and so presumably driving transitions.
What is this movie showing?
It's just showing a sequence of images with different quadrupole moments. That's it. Okay? Deviations from Kerr. So schematically.
Okay. This is supposed to be relevant to this issue of expectation value versus classical.
The different okay. So yeah, let me go a little bit and then you can ask that again. Maybe I'm wrong. Okay. So let's ask, are we going to see some fuzzy image or a sharp image in a very simplified experiment, one where we've replaced the details of this accretion flow with a distant background source. We have our quantum black hole, and then we make some detection. Okay? And moreover, we're going to control the kinds of photons we produce at the source just to ask the question of what it should look like. So our source produces some, let's start with a single photon experiment. So we make one photon from our source, we detect it, we're going to allow our black hole to scramble again and redo this over and over and over again. We send our single photon in towards our quantum black hole. The result is some sort of superposition of or entanglement between outgoing photon states and the black hole quantum state. Okay, we might as well expand this in some sort of scattering eigenstates of the outgoing photons. And if we ask, you know, where on some distant screen, either in a position basis or a momentum basis, and the momentum basis is what we really see with an interferometry experiment. If we ask, what's the probability of finding it at any given momentum? It's just the standard undergraduate quantum mechanics form, which is really some probability of finding the black hole in the relevant scattering eigenstate times the associated probability distribution seeing the photon. So what I call, you know, an image state. Okay, so this looks like a fuzzy black hole. So I should take the average of all of those pictures in the movie. But now let's do a slightly different experiment where I don't just look at one photon at a time, but I send a whole collection of photons through. And if I do that, the probability of getting a specific collection of photons is given by a product of these probabilities in the imaging eigenstate. Okay, and that means that all of the positions of these photons, I'm effectively making an endpoint correlation, all of the positions of these photons end up being correlated. And they're correlated by interaction with the same quantum black hole. Okay? And so to illustrate this, if I imagine doing this experiment where I send n photons through, and then I start probing it with one photon over and over and over again, and ask how collapsed has my wave function become, the answer is it collapses exponentially fast with the number of photons I sent through in the first go. And it depends upon how different the imaging eigenstates are. So this isn't, I think, surprising at all. It means that it's very easy to tell apart quantum states that produce images that look different, and it's very hard to tell apart quantum states that look the same. I don't think that's surprising in the least, but now we can quantify how easy and hard it is. Exponentially easy with more photons. There are complications. You can worry about mixed states. That doesn't really change anything. You collapse the wave function exponentially fast in the same way. A bigger problem would be noise. All radio observations are noise dominated, overwhelmingly so. When you introduce noise, so now you have your photons are the ones that are associated with your source and entangled to your black hole, but there's also a whole bunch of noise photons, which are not. When you include noise, then the collapse looks very similar, although slightly different. Okay, it goes as the L2 norm between the two images and depends upon the signal-to-noise ratio of your instrument. Okay, and so these things we know for the EHT. The signal-to-noise ratio for the instrument is somewhere between 3,000 and 30,000 in 20 seconds for Sagittarius Star. And that means that we'll be able to distinguish quantum states of the black hole that produce differences in the image of 0.01%. Okay, so that sounds great to me, actually. You know, tiny fraction of a percent is the kind of number I like, but let me admit, Planck mass is small. Okay, so we have a long, long way to go. All right, so just some concluding remarks. We have already have in hand the first image quality observations from the EHT. We're in the process of analyzing those. Look for them next spring. There's a number of ways that we can assess classical gravity, and of course we're working on we have employed some of those in the past. We're working on employing them in the new EHT era. Coming up, okay? So there was a lot of discussion about things like quadrupoles, et cetera. We're gonna have a lot to say about that. I would have said extreme. I think I would still say extreme, but maybe with a question mark after all the discussions over the past 3 days. Quantum gravity models, we might see something in the EHT, and it would be characterized by seeing a sequence of images that changed on time scales of the light crossing time of the black hole that were not Kerr images, okay? Because we would be projecting it into as close an image eigenstate as we could each time we make that observation.
So you have resolutions of order 1 second, let's say. EHT, the time resolution is 1 second. So you detect changes.
Well, okay, so we take data at 16 gigabits per second. The shortest correlation time I think we could practically do is a second. That's right. For Sagittarius Star, the light crossing time, gm over c cubed, is 20 seconds. For M87, it's more like 9 hours. So everything I described is tailored for Sagittarius Star, but in principle, we could do it all for M87 as well. And you know, numbers get a little bit larger then.
But your phase averaging, well, the averaging time was longer than the characteristic time on scale for Sagittarius Star.
For imaging.
Oh, okay.
For imaging. So that's the important thing about doing this in the momentum basis. Okay, so the actual experiment that we should do is not make a picture and watch the picture fluctuate. We should look at the visibilities and watch the visibilities fluctuate over. I mean, the visibilities are at the same location in spatial frequencies for of order 10 minutes. So then you have 30 such fluctuations, and we'll see some irreducible noise if there's quantum gravity imposing itself on EHT observations.
Right, couldn't that be just due to fluctuations in accretion?
Well, yes and no. So the typical fluctuation timescales for the accretion flow are going to depend upon exactly where you are, but at the ISCO, that's like half an hour.
Okay.
So I think if we saw an irreducible noise on timescales of 20 seconds, I think it would actually be quite difficult to chalk that up to accretion variability.
That's right, but you're talking about the fluctuation of 10 to minus 2%.
Yeah.
Can you really exclude that it's due to the aggression risk?
It's
a dangerous
thing. Right. Sure. Especially when we've not shown you the kind of data we can do that on yet. Right. So that's right. You know, in 5 years, I think we're going to know how to do that very well.
Is this your final slide? Or
that's it. Concluding remarks.
So that's
thank you.
Just a small percentage of the radiation comes from within the photosphere.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So to me, this means that it would be very hard to probe the horizon, in fact, right? Because I guess that the question, I mean, to probe, say, the gravastar model, you would mm-hmm. like to have radiation that comes from a much smaller distance from the horizon. Say, I don't know, even Planckian, if you want to probe quantum gravity.
Well, what do you mean by probe the horizon? So if what you mean is measure deviations of Planck scale from the horizon, yeah, that will be really hard. If what you mean is probe whether or not there's a photosphere at very high redshift, in that case, a much larger fraction of the, almost all the emission at infrared wavelengths would be coming from that. Right, so that's a somewhat different statement. That sort of thing isn't included in that picture. What?
It would be the photosphere telescope.
It would be the photosphere telescope. Yeah, right. You know what? We would live. If we discovered a photosphere around a supermassive black hole, we would live with the shame of misnaming our instrument.
It's really bad.
Thank you.
So you mentioned that there's a possibility that
you were talking at some point about sending things into the black hole and then maybe making measurements after that, right?
Sending things into the black hole and making measurements. You mean all of these sorts of things?
Yeah.
Sending them by the black hole, not into the black hole, right? So we're going to have the whole point is to have a well-defined photon state initially so I can calculate something. Send it towards the black hole and it interacts. And then I get something on the other side. So you can think of this as sort of a scattering process, but not necessarily into
the black hole. There's this Hawking radiation bath near the black hole just outside it. So you're more likely to scatter these things from that bath, or would you reach actually somewhere? The bath would sort of scatter many things that you send on it, right? Because you come to places where you get electron positrons and, you know, even the quark is still quite away from the horizon.
So I'm imagining that the quantum nature of the black hole is affecting the structure of the space-time, so it's affecting the lensing. Not that we are scattering off of the one Hawking photon. Well, I mean, in principle, we can get down to the photon orbit. I mean, that actually gets, I should mention, that gets better as you go to higher spin. So if you ask what fraction comes from the photon orbit, it gets marginally better. It was a couple percent. It gets marginally better if you spin up the black hole. But yeah, so that's kind of what I'm imagining, that if there's an impact on the space-time, inside inside the photon orbit, and it's a, like a 1% type effect there, which sounds good to an astronomer. That'd be great.
Dilute, right? It's one Hawking photon emitted per light crossing time.
I think it's even worse than that. If you actually get the factors right,
there's an
it's 100 crossing times and like an 8m wavelength. It's actually dismal.
Yeah, no, factors of order unity that are actually of order 100.
Right, right.
So, Alex,
yeah. So it was just a question you had on your conclusion slide, which was you've seen apparent horizon, but how do you get to event horizon? Is there any hope? And what do you mean? How are you going to get to see event horizon?
That's
ruled out conceptually, no?
Well, yeah. So if I, you know, that's a really good point. I think I would say that if we saw something that convinced us there was still a horizon after something like a page time, that would be a bit more convincing. But no, I agree with you. Teleologically defined things are hard to. That's right. But I guess the question is, you know, how long does it take these things to leak out? How long do we have to keep them there? And the longer that we can push that.
But you don't know. I mean, you don't know if tomorrow something is going to fall in.
Yeah, you're right.
But
they can
still, I mean...
The event horizon is some rays that are going out and they're going to become trapped.
But still, I mean, you can think that you're already at infinity. I mean, that infinity is a time scale that's relative to what you choose, right?
But you're presupposing that nothing else is going to fall in?
No. I mean, you just decide that once you've already...
Infinity.
That's something that you can define.
If it's gotten to us, it's pretty likely it's going to keep going.
Yeah.
Unless there's an enormous black hole around us.
And we don't know.
I mean, it's not going to be the strict event
horizon.
There's
Andromeda coming
right,
our way.
Of course, getting the strict event horizon is something that it doesn't even make sense because we're not in the last
sure.
Situation, right?
Well,
yeah,
I
mean, that's something
that's...
Emil has something to say.
Well, I wanted to go a little bit deeper into the statements about current horizon. Maybe these are older arguments, but I think they've been updated by Ramesh and various people in the audience. So I was wondering if you could go through that. So I wrote down 3 points here and see if you agree that in order to make these statements about nothing coming out from a surface, it seems to me that you need three things. One, that basically everything or almost everything that falls in gets reflected back out. Because that's a very low percentage and it's mostly absorbed, you can't say anything. Secondly, you have to say something about the thermalization time. So if stuff falls in, so whatever the surface is, it has to take some time to thermalize. And that sounds like the assumption is that that's very fast and you don't have to worry about it, but it might not be. And the third thing is even if one is under satisfied, you still have to worry about just the GR effect. That if you have a very deeply redshifted surface, it's hard to climb out of it unless you're in a very narrow cone. And as far as we were just looking up the paper, I guess it's in your paper, right? That from Sagittarius Star, the best bound, if I quote that right, is that the redshift measured in this delta R over R Schwarzschild is about 10 to the minus 15. Sagittarius Star, which is very impressive, but still far away from what it would have to be to a lot of ground stars.
So let's.
I'm just wondering if you agree with this, or have I misunderstood something?
So I agree with parts of this, right? So certainly we make a. Apparently we're persona non grata.
That's the end of the discussion.
That's it. Sorry. Come back later. So I agree that we're making assumptions about the thermalization time. I think that's probably the weakest link.
You're assuming it's very short compared
to the observation. No. Because the time integrated accretion rate on Sagittarius Star is almost certainly much higher than it is today. You know, effectively we're assuming the thermalization time is short in comparison to 10 gigayears. Okay, but that, you know, you can argue that it need not be that short, depending upon the details Well, depending on not just the history of the accretion, but the nature of whatever you put there.
Okay.
The absorption and reflection. Yeah, you're right. So if it has, you know, if it absorbs, I think the estimate we came up with was about 99.8% or so of the energy, then you can get away with that. Right? So that's starting to be pretty high. The time for escape, I'd have to go through that with you guys, because you know the time scale for a photon escaping is actually not very long at all, except for the fact that it has to be aimed in the right direction. Okay, so this I agree with. But the time scale for escaping, even from a high redshift surface, just logarithmically grows with the redshift.
That's right.
But the whole point was that as you approach steady state, that you're going to drive the temperature of the surface up high enough that you're going to get enough photons there that they're going to come out. Now that raises a different point, which is as you heat the surface up, you're creating this very hot thing. And this very hot thing has energy, has mass, and this doesn't make any sense if that hot thing is more massive than the black hole. So that does put a separate bound on this.
Yeah, that's a separate bound.
That's a separate bound, yeah.
But I think that the point is that the smaller the epsilon, the longer it will take to reach the steady state.
No. Only logarithmically, because it's just like lifeguards, right? The person's drowning over there. How do you get to them? You run along the beach, right? You don't go in a straight line because you can't swim as fast, right?
No. That's incorrect. So there's an assumption that there's thermalization between the stuff in the object and the accretion disk that you have.
Yeah.
Let me continue. Even though time scales logarithmically, okay, the time for infall, the opening angle is so small for escape that actually it scales linearly with M. So with epsilon, sorry. So the time scale that you need to thermalize all these outgoing photons that eventually fall back is much larger.
I think we would have to go back and take a look at this, because most the ones that you'll have lots of photons that go out, come around, and come back down.
Right.
You'll have a lot of them that go sideways.
It's the same as closing a black body in a box.
Yeah, okay? Just can't get out.
They just can't get out. You can throw one inside.
That's
exactly.
You don't see.
Yeah.
Period. It doesn't matter how fast.
Yeah. Unless you make it hot enough. So this is the whole point of it having to be in steady state. The outgoing luminosity far. Well, okay.
You know, if you decouple the black body from this pinhole that you have, you're gone. I mean, you can warm it up as much as you want. You still need to find a way for the photons to get out.
Right. How big do you need the pinhole to be?
Yeah, but I think that even 10 to the minus 30 is enough. You think something can get out, so, I mean, it's 1-0.
It's 10 to minus 30 is way too small.
What is it, 30?
The estimate for is 10 to minus 15.
Let me put a pin in that argument, because I'm not sure I agree with that. But there's another point, which I think is really important, and that is, this argument is ironclad when it comes to neutron star exobatteries. And the reason is because we know exactly the answer to all these questions when it comes to impinging on a neutron star surface. If I have a bunch of baryonic material that's impinging on my thing, and it's not allowed to instantly change its character and become the thing, even if the thing has zero temperature, I will create a baryonic atmosphere of finite height, because I'm constantly heating it at the top, and I know everything about how that thermalizes. And so my argument to these, you know, more exotic objects is that, well, we're just going to build up a baryonic atmosphere, and then that's going to be pushing it out to much further out than the Planck length, and it's going to evade, you know, I'm not going to have to worry about how that thermalizes, and we're going to be able to see the emission from that. Now, but that's, again, something we've got to calculate.
That's a,
yeah.
So I think that
even for neutrons, the atmosphere, I think, is millimeters, right? So for these objects, will be even
much smaller.
No. I'm not sure why that matters. The point is that we'll make a baryonic atmosphere, and however big it is, I know how to calculate the thermalization times.
So let me just remark that since one imagines one, I mean, I don't have a dynamical, fully dynamical theory, but the sequence of steady states. So one can imagine that if the accretion rate is slow enough, it will actually just be absorbed, material, just like a black hole.
Right.
Then this argument just seems to me to
Oh, well, yeah. So that's certainly right.
It has to be calculated.
So that's exactly right. You know, the way a black hole evades this whole argument is it absorbs it. Right, so it's not necessary.
Right.
So how does the infalling material become whatever it is,
that's
right?
That's the right question. But if it's above 99.5%, the whole thing is over, right?
Right.
So maybe the one last question from Rami.
So you were describing stuff that you might or might not see. What would be your best bet for stuff that you can actually see with confidence? No, I'm asking.
So what do you mean? If are you asking, do I believe all this quantum black hole stuff I described?
I'm asking. you spend a lot of time explaining classical effects.
Yeah, yeah.
So it seems that you were more confident that you could actually probe these classical effects. And I was wondering what would be those classical effects that you were more sure that you can actually say something specific about.
Well, I mean, there's a whole slew of astrophysical things. I think we're going to settle the story on whether or not MHD turbulence drives accretion. We're going to settle the story on how black hole jets are launched and the role black hole spin plays in that process.
You have proven JR by 10% in the conclusion.
Yeah. The 10% stuff. That's really straightforward. We're going. Effectively, we're going to have a photon orbit mass estimate. Scale mass estimate to compare to, you know, the stellar orbits are at thousands of gravitational radii. So, you know, you compare these two. I think I don't know if we're going to quite get to a percent in the next couple of years on looking for quadrupoles, but I think we're going to get there eventually. It depends, you know, we've built the tools to do the joint astrophysics and gravitational fits. And now it's just a matter of applying them. I'm reasonably certain that we're going to learn something about the space-time from the dynamics, from these rare, bright, no, not so rare, once a day, bright events. So exactly what we're going to learn, I can't tell you immediately. But you know, we do have more than one way to access classical gravity. If we did have something that was fluctuating order 100%, okay, so sort of a very extreme picture of the model that Steve talked about, and then backed away from here today or yesterday, it was the idea that you do have large fractional fluctuations in the space-time on short timescales. We would see that. I just don't believe that that's true. So what I told Steve before was there's 0% chance we'll see it, but it would be infinitely important if we did. So the product is a finite number.
So I think it probably is a good time to move to the general discussion, and this would be basically the wrap up for the full conference. Is that the general discussion thing? Okay, so let's thank Avery again.